From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. This week, we revisit our conversation with multi-hyphenate Bradley Cooper. To get a shot at directing his remake of A Star Is Born, Cooper passed on an upfront payday in exchange for a piece of the profit. And that gamble paid off. But as he is painfully aware, the movie business has changed.
Those days are completely gone. So there is trepidation I have with that, no question. No question. And I have thought like I really have to actively start thinking about other ways of making revenue that have maybe nothing to do with movie making.
In part two of our interview, which originally aired this past January, Bradley Cooper worries about the streaming future. He also remembers picking up filmmaking tips on the set of Alias and shares how he landed the memorable voice of Marvel's Rocket Raccoon. But first, fresh banter looking ahead at 2023. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by not one, but two colleagues in banter, Matt Bellany, founding partner of Puck News, and Lucas Shaw, head of the entertainment team at Bloomberg. Hello, gentlemen.
Hello. Great to be here.
It is great to have you here. We are in person. We are looking at the year ahead, and there are a couple of big looming issues, and I am going to ask my banter buddies here for their opinion. Lucas, strike or no strike in 2023?
I've been leaning no, but I might be about to change my mind. The no for me is just, I don't know that the writers want to go through another painful labor dispute, especially if there's a major recession. However, the last time there was one of these disputes, one of the reasons I don't think there was a big work stoppage is because the studios really needed fresh product. And I think now that a lot of the studios would actually be fine if a strike happened because they're all looking to save money. And if they didn't have to spend a bunch of money on new things, they would find other ways to fill the gaps and they could sell that to Wall Street. I think I'm coming around to the idea that there will be one.
I remember quite a work stoppage. Then, as probably now, they are banking stuff to have in case there is a work stoppage. But Matt, your view?
I think that all signs right now are pointing to a strike. The writers are pissed. They feel that it's not just a money issue. The studios are going to come to them with gains, you know, a couple percentage here, you know, better benefits there. The writers feel that there is a fundamental misalignment in how they are paid vis-a-vis how the studios make money these days. And that is not something that can be resolved that quickly. It's going to take real negotiations, and they're not going to even go to the studios until it's almost too late. If you look at the way that David Goodman and some of these other people with the Writers Guild have operated in the past, they get the strike authorization from the membership, then they go and they say, okay, this is what we want. If the studios say no, they say, okay, we strike, and then we negotiate. So I think that's going to happen. And the way it lines up, it would happen in May. We'd probably have a strike over the summer. Who knows what would happen if people say, okay, we're taking the summer off. We will then, you know, resume production in the fall. I think it's going to be really ugly.
I'll just note that the Directors Guild, which has usually been the easiest and goes first and sometimes sets a pattern, sounding a little more warlike this year. So maybe I'll be noncommittal and say maybe.
It's also strange. You made the point about stockpiling. And oddly, from everything I'm hearing, most studios and networks are not doing as much of the normal strike preparation as they would be.
Because they have all this content that they're trying to figure out what to do with. I mean, you see shows getting unrenewed and you see people's deals being kind of left to languish. So I think that they are recognizing that they have to cut costs. And if there's a strike, yeah, they're going to have stuff that's prepped and ready to go. But it's not like 2007 where it was like everybody is rushing to finish this stuff before the strike right, so they can have product.
We are looking at a cold winter ahead. It certainly looks like with the way the economy is. Quick prediction, yes or no, is there going to be a mega deal in 2023? Some people have taken to the annoyance of David Zaslav, a Warner Brothers Discovery deal with Comcast or NBC Universal as a given. That would be a really big deal. I don't think it can happen this year ahead because of tax considerations and the nature of the deal. But are we expecting something in 23, Matt?
I think so. I think that if the current trajectories hold and the financials of these companies become more perilous and their stock prices stay low where they are, I think all of the incentives are going to align for further consolidation. And I don't know exactly how that's going to play out, whether it will be a combination of Comcast and Warner Brothers Discovery with the reservations you mentioned, or whether it'll be Paramount doing something or Netflix buying something or getting bought. Something's got to happen.
I think you'll see a smaller deal in 2023, by which I mean you know, more than a billion, but less than 10.
Like Lionsgate?
So an AMC Networks, a right. Lionsgate, one of these smaller companies that as the if the market really tanks is going to be in an untenable position. If you're a Warner Brothers Discovery, if you're a Comcast, if you're a Paramount, if you're a Netflix, Disney, so on, it can get really bad, but you're still going to be totally solvent and fine because you're just so big. I think you then have a much bigger deal in 2024 when some of the dust has settled and someone gets opportunistic.
I have to agree with that analysis. That was Lucas Shaw, head of the entertainment team at Bloomberg, and Matt Bellany, founding partner of Puck News. Thank you, gentlemen, for joining.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kim.
That, and who could forget it, is Bradley Cooper and Lady Gaga slaying a global audience at the 2019 Oscars. Cooper was nominated for Best Actor, Best Adapted Screenplay, and Best Picture for his film A Star Is Born. In a previous episode, we talked to him about preparing for those very different roles, but Cooper had much more to say about his experiences in the industry and the state of the business. And honestly, a lot has changed even since then. A lot of times an actor will get a producer credit, but you have a legit PGA producer credit on multiple films, including Joker, which means that you were very involved. Can you tell me a bit how that came to, I mean, obviously you have the relationship with Todd Phillips from the Hangover movies, but how did it come to be?
You know, we got to know each other during the Hangover movies and became friends. And he's very much a lone soldier as a creative person. And for whatever reason, he said, you know, what if we produce some stuff together? We definitely have the same taste in movies. And I was like, are you kidding? Yeah. So we made War Dogs was a thing we produced together. And then Star Is Born we produced together and Joker. And I absolutely loved working on Joker more than I ever thought I would. I worked really, really hard on that film, and I'm so proud of it. And it was a joy to just a joy and an honor to work with the material that he and Joaquin shot together, along with the rest of the cast.
So how would you characterize you worked hard, but what would you say was the main thing that you brought to the table there?
Well, the producer's job is to help the director fulfill their vision in every way that in every capacity, you know. And for different movies, it means different things. I was able to executive produce, but I feel like I did just as much on Silver Linings Playbook and American Hustle, which was different types of producerial duties. On Joker, it was a huge amount in the post process.
Hmm. Interesting. I mean, what about the post-product process for that movie that was just,
I'm just
mean,
you know,
edit,
and I mean, and the screenplay, and you know, and like Robert De Niro, I had a relationship with him, and talking about, you know, whether he, you know, talking to him about doing that, playing that role, you know, just helping Todd being a sounding board for story, all of those things.
Mm. So at this point, you also have a piece of the Marvel Universe as the voice of Rocket Raccoon, which wasn't necessarily a sure thing. You're picking these very, very eclectic projects and roles, you know, in front of, behind the camera. Tell me a little bit about how you just look at something and say yes.
I mean, Rocket Raccoon really was, I got so lucky. James Gunn, I guess, sort of had an idea for me to play Rocket, and then he and I got together. Kim, I can't remember like really what made me say yes, other than I thought of, I don't even remember really, but I do remember finding the voice and being very excited, you know, about the voice. He started out like very Bill the Butcher from Gangsta, New York, and then he turned into like Joe. We were saying like it's like a Joe Pesci meets Gilbert Godfrey.
What a bunch of losers. All of them in a big hurry to get from something stupid to nothing at all. Pathetic.
Look at this guy. You believe they call us criminals when he's assaulting us with that haircut?
And it was just like experimenting, and I would just keep sending him, either I can't remember if I was sending him like voice memos or we were in a room together, but I just kept throwing different types of things, and then we landed on Rocket's voice. And once that happened, It was just really fun. And doing that work on various incarnations of Rocket in the various films, the evolution of how we work has been very interesting. It started out where we would watch playback of the scene, and then I would fill in the gap where the line is. Now, the way that James and I had done it is he reads all the other characters, and we actually perform it as almost a play reading, and it's really fun. So I have a ball doing that.
It really does sound like the best of all possible Marvel worlds, because you don't have to have the body scan and do the green screen. You just get to do the performance.
Well, I mean, I don't really, you know, I do the voice, but James's brother plays Rocket on the set. And that's an invaluable part of the physicality for the other actors and everything.
Yes, these relationships, having directed yourself, I would imagine, I mean, you said you were involved in the producerial way with Silver Linings Playbook and other things, but having directed, I would assume transforms your relationships when you are performing, when you're in front of the camera and interacting with the director. Does your own experience as a director change not in a negative way, but in any way, change the way you react to a director or...
Oh, post Stars Born, you mean?
Yes, yes.
Not really, because I think from day one, I even though I didn't really think I admitted it to myself, because I was probably scared to admit that I really thought I think I was scared to dream so big, but I've always wanted to write and direct movies. I started acting and pursuing acting, but very early on Alias, which was a television show I did in the early 2000s, was like a huge break for me. All I did was care about how they put that. I was just fascinated by what JJ did in the pilot, and then meeting Ken Olin and sitting there with Marianne and Mary Beth, the editors in the editing room of Alias. There was another editor as well. And I would shadow Ken Olin all the time and get everybody's dailies on VHS back at this. I was living in like the bottom floor of a woman's house. This Kate, her name was, up on Fairfax. And all I did was like, was learn how they put that thing together. How does one do that? I was just check the gate, all these terms. I just soaked it all up. And I realized early on that, like, well, it's not exactly like other actors. And then I did this movie, Midnight Meat Train, where Ruhei Kitamura was able to, like, really let me into his process. And I was playing a character that was in every scene. So I really got to understand what it is to put a story together. And then, like, Limitless, with Neil Berger, I had a chance to really be a part of it, and I executive produced that. And so, and then with David O. Russell, and then really a book that I came across, American Sniper, with Clint Eastwood, and he was so collaborative. And also because I think he knew that I had such a love for the material and that character that he saw us as partners. We're always thinking about story, always thinking about all the characters. And so it really never, being able to do it myself with A Star Is Born was incredible. And I learned a tremendous amount, but it definitely, that same perspective I've always had in every job I've had even like my first job as an extra in a Dell Computers commercial, I remember like I was all the way in the back in the field throwing a football, and all I was thinking about was what was that crane thing they were using, and just trying to figure out how they were putting this together.
Coming up after a short break, Bradley Cooper tells us with the industry shifting shapes, he might start selling pizza. He's joking, sort of. You're listening to The Business from KCRW. This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're revisiting our most popular episode of 2022, the second part of our interview with multi-hyphenate Bradley Cooper, whose next project is Maestro, a film about Leonard Bernstein that he's co-writing, directing, and starring in for Netflix. Cooper had two projects in theaters earlier this year. He played real-life wild man producer John Peters in Licorice Pizza. And he starred as Stanton Carlisle, a carnival worker with a shady past, in Nightmare Alley. That dark drama from Oscar winner Guillermo del Toro began its streaming life on Hulu and HBO Max February 1st. That was earlier than expected, but perhaps not surprising. Nightmare Alley came out in mid-December 2021, and did not perform at the box office. This is a very dark movie. I'd say a sad, ultimately very sad movie, right? And you're in pretty much every frame. What makes you say yes? Is it because of Guillermo? Is it because the material or combo?
You know, the truth is, Kim, you know, I'd finished A Star Is Born, and I couldn't believe that I knew at that point before A Star Is Born came out that I wanted to explore this movie that I'm going to start shooting in May. So I had this other thing that I couldn't believe. I didn't know I would ever make another movie, but I was in the middle of researching and writing a movie about marriage between Leonard Bernstein and Felicia Montalegre. And I knew just how much work that entailed. So I didn't think I was going to do anything. And then this project that I knew about, because Leonardo DiCaprio was going to do it, and I think Jennifer Lawrence, and then Leo dropped out, and then Guillermo, I got a call that Guillermo wanted to meet me. And really, it was like, I couldn't believe that I'm the next guy that he was going to go to. I felt like, well, of course I have to do it. Like, just because of that, like, he wants me to do something in his movie. Like, yeah. And then, like, the cast that was assembled at that time already, which was Willem Dafoe was already cast. I think Toni Collette, Rooney Mara, David Strathairn, Ron Perlman, Mark Povinelli, Richard Jenkins. It was just insane cast. And then Cate Blanchett. And I met with Guillermo and I just thought, oh, geez, I don't know how I can't do this, but I don't know how I'm going to be able to. It wasn't even based on the material. It was just based on the caliber of artistry. And then Guillermo even said it when we first met. He said, I think you need to do this movie in order to be able to do Maestro. And he was so right. That was one of the truest things he said.
Well, wait a minute. Just tell me why. Why did you need to do it to do that? I'm trying to connect with Leonard Bernstein.
I didn't realize it at the time. But I think just the scope of the film, the rhythm of that movie, and so many things. But it all became a discovery, Kim, I guess is where I'm leading to. But I didn't know at the time what he meant, really. but he was so right. Stanton Carlisle is a character that was so hard for me to play. But I didn't think, like, all these things, this movie was at every turn surprised me. It was definitely, I think it was the hardest role I've ever played, I think. And I've played some really difficult roles for me. But this one really, really was difficult. So that I didn't think was going to happen. I was terrified of this role. I didn't think that was going to happen. And I collaborated with Guillermo in a way that I didn't think we were going to collaborate. And we really were friends for life after this film. We really went through, you know, you go into the trenches with somebody when you make a movie. And we really did. It was a very difficult film to make. For many circumstances, COVID being one of them, and just the weather and the cast and, all the normal things. But I think because of what the movie wound up being about, you know, Stan, I think Stan could have been more sort of theatrical. Do you know what I mean? And more sort of foppish or rakish, maybe that's the term. But instead, it really became an exploration of the failed construct of man. That's it. It was very like, it was like surgically about one thing. And the character, you know, became a character that you don't hear talk for the first 15 minutes of the movie. All these things are things that we discovered as the movie evolved. And you're watching this guy who's sort of half dead, then learn how another means of survival until eventually, you know, the words that Lilith says, you know, what do I want? And he says, what everybody else wants to be found out. Health, wealth, and love. That's where you hit him. And she says, you know, find out what they're afraid of and sell it back to them. He said, yes, as long as you don't oversell it. And that's like, that's it. That's what the movie's about. That was a very scary thing to play because for many reasons. One, I thought like, well, if I'm the sort of guide for the audience, I'm not really doing anything. Don't I need to do something in order to, like, I don't know, they're going to be bored or am I going to, like, drop the ball? So really giving over to the story and trusting it and then allowing all the preparation that I did serve itself. Things are going to just happen, you know, that you don't know. And that happened kind of in every single scene. Things happened that I had no idea were going to happen. And that's very gratifying.
I mean, this film was released theatrically at a difficult time, and which definitely, I think, did take a toll. But did you want that to be a theatrical exclusive? Did you care? Are you Switzerland? Where are you on that?
Where I was, you know, it wasn't a shock to any of us how it landed theatrically. You know, that was their choice, Fox Searchlight, and I didn't have that money to pay for the movie, so you know, that's above my pay grade.
Right.
I do think that it's a wonderful movie to see in the theater, just because the scope of it all. But I do think it's also will be very. Appetizing at home. The thing that I always go back to, Kim, is like nothing like great content will hit you right between the eyes, right? No matter mm-hmm. what it is. If it's an incredible haiku, you know what I mean? It can stay with you for years and change your life. I was born in 1975. There was a theater behind me, behind my house with train tracks and then a movie theater. I saw some great movies there, but the movies that changed my life and inspired me to do what I do for a vocation were The Elephant Man and Godfather and Apocalypse Now and Shampoo and Coming Home and Deer Hunter. All of those movies I saw on a 16-inch television set. So I never saw those movies in a movie theater. I've never seen The Godfather in a movie theater. I've never seen Apocalypse Now in a movie theater. And I certainly never saw Raging Bull or Taxi Driver or any of those movies in a movie theater, or Goodfellas for that matter. So,
And I
think a lot of people, that's the case.
Yes, no doubt.
So as long as people are paying or allowing people or funding people to create content, and if it happens to be seen on a smaller platform, I think that's okay. Now, that said, I definitely was aware that in The Star Is Born, that it would be a different experience because of the musical element to see it in a theater, because I really shot it and scored it and mixed it in a way that in Atmos, in a theater, that you really do feel that I was creating experience for the audience to be on that stage in during a live concert. So I do think there is a difference with certain films. And Maestro, this movie I'm gonna conduct, you know, Mahler's Second Symphony, The Resurrection, and the way I'm gonna shoot it, like, it will be different if you're seeing it in a theater. But that just is because I think the musical element to it.
Hmm. I don't know. I mean, I've been watching some of the movies that are, you know, out and about this time and watching them, you know, on the streamer. And I sort of hear this little voice saying, you should be seeing me in a theater, which is kind of a new thing. But and maybe one of them was Tick, Tick, Boom, which is a big musical element to it, you know. But I feel like some of these movies are asking, but maybe it's because I'm, you know, at a certain age and I grew up with an idea about what movies are. I don't know. Do you feel?
But did you see all those movies I'm talking about? Did you see all of them in a movie theater?
I can't even go back through the list, but I'm sure I didn't. I've seen some movies I'd be a bit embarrassed to admit that I watched on a plane, you know, but I did.
Right.
But I take your point that things land if they are, art will land. But I don't know. Do you just feel like the future is what the future is, because we are at a moment, as you undoubtedly know, where theaters are challenged, studios are messing around with experiments. You know, Warner's went this way, then they pulled back. We don't know what we think the window will be. Is there a window? How committed are they? Does it worry you about the future of film, or do you say, let it be what it is?
Well, I mean, there's two different ways to approach that answer. One is on a personal level, in terms of like how I can make a living has completely changed, because I've only bet on myself on movies and always bet on that the movie would do well. And in it doing well, I would get paid, and upfront, I would not get paid. And because of that, I would hedge my bet. And the upside, if it was successful, I would be paid a lot more. Those days are completely gone. So, and there is trepidation I have with that. No question. And I have thought like, I really have to actively start thinking about other ways of making revenue that have maybe nothing to do with movie making, you know?
Wow.
Because I just, I don't know that the movies that I want to make, I'll ever get paid, really. You know what I mean?
No,
a lot of money.
You have no skin in the game, right? Mm-hmm.
You know, so like Maestro, I'm just so lucky that Netflix is going to pay for the movie. You know what I mean? But that's just so the movie can get made. You know what I mean? But there's no back end. There's no
Right.
That's for the love of the game. That's why I'm doing that movie, you know, but I'm so grateful that they're allowing me to make it. I couldn't.
Yeah.
Scott Stuber, thank the Lord.
Yeah, that's always the thing, right? Whether it's Roma or your movie, they'll make it.
Yeah, I mean, and they're the only place that would make it. I mean, Netflix is the only place that would make that movie.
Same with The Irishman. You know, they like to say they're in business with certain talent, but they get there often by being the only place that will make it on the terms that the person wants.
I mean, this is not a budget of Irishman, but I mean, even not even close, but they're the only place to make it.
So,
yeah, But so in that case, there is fear because I'm like, oh, geez. From another standpoint, I feel, you know, I don't think that the theater going experience will ever go away. Like opera has never gone away and other things have never gone away. And I think that if a movie is made in a way that it's most ideally seen in a theater, I think that there will be the availability, the access for someone, if they wanted to see it in a theater. Do you know what I mean?
I hope so. Yeah. I mean, call me old fashioned.
I think so. I mean, I think that'll be around for a while. I think.
So when you say moving away from movies, are you meaning like, are you saying limited series or you develop a beachfront hotel in Miami, which is probably a really bad idea?
I don't know, man. It might be. I don't even know what it means, Kim. I don't know. Maybe it's like opening up a pizza shop. I really don't know.
Wow. Well, I think people will be very pleased if you actually continue to make films in any manifestation.
Oh, no, I don't mean that I would stop making moves. I definitely don't mean that. I'm just saying that I never thought about, it's just everything changed in that respect. The way that I've made money is over. That's all.
Yeah. Unless you are, you know, in a tiny little pyramid, top of the pyramid, I guess, place. Or, you know, I'm looking back at Joker and thinking about how that was made for a number and then the upside was there. You know, in certain circumstances, maybe a deal like that gets made, right?
Yeah, maybe. And, you know, but for example, I bet on myself for American Sniper and for A Star Is Born. You know what I mean? I don't know if that kind of box office revenue for an R-rated drama will happen again. And Joker's the same thing. Yeah, I don't know. You know, but Joker had a property, you know, an IP that was different. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know what you're doing next. It's Maestro. So that's what we will. Well, you have a lot of stuff in development, though. So I think you're going to be doing this for quite a while, is my guess. And you weren't even expecting to do Nightmare Alley. So that just came out of left field. So, okay.
And Licorice Pizza. Yeah.
Oh, so serendipity plays a big role still. Let me do this. Bradley Cooper. Well, he's Bradley Cooper. He was also an actor, producer, writer, and director. All of those things. He stars in Nightmare Alley and has a very memorable role in Licorice Pizza. Both roles memorable, I will note. Thank you so much for talking to us today.
Oh, thank you. That was a fascinating discussion.
And that's The Business for 2022. Caitlin Parker and Joshua Farnham produced and edited today's program with help this week from John Meek, Desmond Taylor, and Paul Smith, who also mixed the show. You can stream The Business, as well as other great KCRW podcasts, on the KCRW app. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next year on The Business.